The Monument and the Field, Nicholas Hawksmoor's Churches in Georgian London by Pier Vittorio Orelli. And it's from OACE 97. And there's an opening quote. No fun to hang around feeling that same old way. No fun to hang around freaked out for another day. The Stooges, No Fun, 1969. 1. The relationship between architecture and the city has always been difficult. While architecture as a, quote, work of art can be conceptualized as an outstanding object, the city, and especially the modern city, is the outcome of a multitude of economic interests materialized through rules and regulations such as building codes, plot sizes, costs, functions, etc. While architecture ends up being a memorable object or a monument, the city is a field, an expanded domain saturated by anonymous structures and textures. Built of standardized repetitive elements, the urban field is the result of economic parameters and design formulas rather than of architectural intentions. The English terraced house is a radical embodiment of this field. It was the protagonist in 18th century Georgian London and the byproduct of economic speculation. The terraced house is an inhabitable box with an exterior of exposed brick masonry and minimal ornamentation, mostly concentrated on the lower part of the facade. Here, architecture was reduced to mere utility. Today, Georgian London may seem pleasant and picturesque, but it used to provoke a sense of doom, desolation, and brutality. Because of its market-driven logic and its monotony, the phenomenon of the terraced house is considered as an early example of modern suburbia. When this generic housing model was proliferating all over London, one of the finest 18th century architects, Nicholas Hawksmoor, designed churches that were perceived by his contemporaries as idiosyncratic, bold, and monumental. We know that Hawksmoor was horrified by the development of London in the 18th century. We don't know what he exactly thought of the architecture of the terraced houses, but given the sophistication and the deliberate monumentality of his architecture, it isn't difficult to imagine how he felt the urgency to conceive architectural forms that would counter the London that came into being at the beginning of the 18th century. I would like to revisit the clash between Hawksmoor's churches and Georgian London, because I believe that this rather awkward and unbalanced confrontation exemplifies a fundament of the modern city. The unresolvable tension between the city as a gigantic machine for the extraction of surplus value and an architecture that tries to be the embodiment of other, quote, values. Today, we all seem to agree that within the capitalist city, architecture with a capital A is condemned to be an increasingly irrelevant exception. If it is not already complicit with the norm, it pretends to overcome. And yet I would still like to ask if architectural exceptions are capable of opening up meaningful cracks, or if they are destined to be swallowed by the field, whose market-driven logic turns everything into economic value. 2. In his introduction to Rob Krier's book, Urban Space, Colin Rowe wrote that something went wrong in the history of city form at the beginning of the 18th century. At that time, after many civil wars, restorations, and revolutions, London was ready to become a huge and fast-growing metropolis. As is often the case in urban history, the roots of the urban momentum was a catastrophe, the Great Fire that had destroyed large parts of London in 1666. Rather than rebuilding the city according to a unitary plan, such as the one drafted by Christopher Wren based on a regular gridiron cut by monumental avenues, London was reconstructed by respecting the existing intricate street patterns and property lines. Unlike other European cities in the 17th century, London had no major public plans and development was driven by private wealth. The prerogatives of the monarchy were limited, and church property was almost absent. So even before the Great Fire, London was developed by an entrepreneurial class of landowners and developers. This led to the typology of the terraced house, aligned along the road and divided by sidewalls. This simple organisation was the result of an economic purpose, to build as many houses as possible at the lowest price. The rows appear as a continuous front, pierced by unadorned windows and minimally decorated doors. Terraced houses were designed not by architects, but by bricklayers, carpenters, and developers. They were the product of a ruthless business attitude that did not spare even what would be later on considered one of the finest contributions to English urbanism, Covent Garden. Although the architect of this square, Inigo Jones, gave the piazza a monumental air, its residential architecture was made of the plain continuity of arcades and fenestrations. Covent Garden became the prototype of an increasing private-led development after the Great Fire. Landowners would urbanise suburban areas by building squares surrounded by endless rows of terraced houses. Within this typology, all housing components were standardised to make construction as cheap as possible, resulting in the transformation of housing into a commodity. It is not a coincidence that when Marx described the difference between use value and exchange value of a commodity, he referred to a ruthless London builder of terraced houses, Nicholas Barbon. Use value is the effective utility of an object. Exchange value is economic value, the price of an object on the market, independent of its material properties. As John Summerson noted, Barbon celebrated his building activity not as art, but as a successful form of trade because of the large number of subsidiary trades. A house is not a building, but an apparatus involving a myriad of economic transactions, buying, leasing, standardising, renting, selling, etc. What matters is the creation of value. As Barbon, quoted by Marx, wrote, when value is the purpose of a process, quote, 100 pounds worth of lead or iron is of as great value as 100 pounds of silver and gold. The result is a powerful form of abstraction. A window or a door is no longer the outcome of handicraft, but also, and especially, the result of parameters imposed by the market. The extensively standardised terraced house embodied the abstraction of commodity exchange by reducing the house to a plain kit of parts. Walls, windows, doors, stairs, fireplaces, closets, decorations, and so forth. For the first time in history, domestic space was devoid of symbols of its content. The terraced house has a front and a back, yet the plan and section show a simple disposition. Front and back parlour, front and back bedroom are interchangeable. This spatial logic transcended social classes and included all sorts of domestic arrangements. The detail that fully reveals the abstraction is the wooden window frame, set back in order to minimise exposed woodwork and fire hazard, and to expose the brick masonry as a naked wall. In the terraced house, architecture was reduced to its essence as an object, and this exposed objecthood was a product of abstract economical facts. 3. In 1711, when Georgian London was being built, Nicholas Hawksmoor was appointed surveyor of the commission to build 50 new churches. The goal was to insert religious authority in London, especially amid the newly built suburbs. In spite of the programme's boldness, Hawksmoor managed to build only 6 churches. He also designed the spire for the Church of St. Luke of 1740, probably the strangest spire ever built, a plain tower topped by a tall obelisk. Hawksmoor attempted to let the churches boldly stand out among the mediocre new city fabric. It must have been quite an experience to walk along the infinite runs of identical terraced houses and to be confronted suddenly with the monumental feature of an obelisk. His appointment can be compared to Christopher Wren's commission to rebuild 50 churches after the Great Fire of 1666. Wren's churches were relatively modest artefacts, with an exterior largely made out of the same brick masonry of the houses, lightly adorned with simplified frames. Only the elaborated spires counterpointed the restraint. Hawksmoor's churches were not only monumental in form, but also in terms of used material. The white stone contrasted with the grey brick of the new housing. Hawksmoor's goal was to create a congregational space whose architecture would recall the early church of the primitive Christians. Therefore, he searched for references unadulterated by traditional Catholic church building, such as the Hagia Sophia in Istanbul or Fischer von Erlach's exotic reconstruction of the, quote, Seven Wonders. Such references address the possibility for a church prototype that would stand out as an isolated object, starkly opposed to its context. Churches like St. Mary Woolnoth and Christchurch in Spitalfields look like stones thrown into a context that they confront with the absoluteness of their heavy mass. This antagonism is emphasized by the exterior treatment. In spite of their formal inventiveness and originality, Hawksmoor's churches are the result of an ornamental vocabulary made of restrained, almost abstracted elements such as unframed openings, stripped down posts and lintel frames around doors and empty niches. This detailing emphasizes the massiveness of the church architecture, but it also echoes the terraced houses' abstract detailing, such as the unframed windows and the horizontal bands between floors. Yet while the abstraction in the latter is a default byproduct of economic optimization, the abstraction in Hawksmoor's decoration is intentional and confrontational. It turns architecture into a composition of heavy masses. This tendency towards confrontational abstraction is evident in one of Hawksmoor's most revealing drawings about his architectural approach, the northeast perspective of St. Mary Warwick, a burnt-down church for which Hawksmoor proposed a reconstruction following the original Gothic style. Here the church architecture is rendered as a composition of bare volumes. The only ornament is the play of light and shadow. This drawing reveals how Hawksmoor conceived architecture as an idiosyncratic composition of pure volumes, a purity that in his London churches was exalted by the whiteness of the Portland stone. Even today, in a dramatically changed context, the churches preserve their isolation vis-a-vis all that surrounds them. What makes the building specifically outstanding are elaborate and eccentric spires. In St. Elphege and St. George Bloomsbury, the spire is relatively autonomous from the body of the church. But in Christ Church and St. Anne Limehouse, it absorbs the facade and the church appears as a gigantic funeral monument. In his study of Hawksmoor, Vaughan Hart emphasized how the tradition of ancient funeral architecture was a fundamental reference for Hawksmoor. Crucial in this regard were monuments such as the mausoleum of Halicarnassus, the tomb of Cecilia Metella along the Via Appia, and the tomb of the legendary Etruscan king Porsena. These tombs inspired Hawksmoor to a monumentality untamed by familiar features of Catholic architecture, such as the stacking of classical orders, pediments, or domes. Built as piles of volumes, ancient monuments evoked a sense of respect, but also of doom. They differ from the traditional civic monument, the temple or the basilica, because they remain aloof, solitary, and disconnected from mundane reality. It is not by chance that Hawksmoor's spire of St. George appears in William Hogarth's famous depiction of Gin Lane from 1751, a crude vignette of the doom in Georgian London, where to hang around was certainly no fun at all. Amid an unredeemable social chaos where vice, corruption, and mortality reign supreme, Hawksmoor's landmark appears as a monument devoid of civic orientation. Funeral monuments do not celebrate what is alive, but what has been lost. They don't just commemorate, but also admonish about the caducity of life, seen from the vantage point of death's inevitability. The contrasting monumentality of Hawksmoor's churches is so pronounced that it verges on the monstrous. Monumentum, which means to remember, to commemorate. Yet this word is derivative of the verb monere, to admonish. The etymological root of the word monster, an exceptional form and a species of one individual. Both the words monument and monster refer to terrifying things, whose goal is to admonish those who behold them. If monuments are meant to be the city's fulcrum, their form can also be antagonistic. This is true for Hawksmoor's churches, whose gloomy grandeur is more fearsome than reassuring. To a city that was becoming the modern urban norm, a gigantic commodity, they opposed a hopeless and monstrous monumentality and the brutal materiality of stony masses. These churches may seem to anticipate present-day landmarks that force architecture to be, quote, special in order to catch our distracted attention. Yet the monumentality of Hawksmoor's work, with its funeral air, is bold and restrained, confrontational and hermetic. Even unplugged from the religious fervour that created them, the sheer presence of these objects opens up a gap in the urban field of London where market volatility dominates everything.